This is the one with straw men,
little green men,
boys to men,
watchmen,
old men,
and dead men.
It's called The Family of Blood.
Here we go.
We're still on our endless voyage, all through time and all through space.
With Levine and Angels now, Dalek, Soilus, Zandu, Lau.
Tennant, Smith and Eccleston, Gallifrey, where it all began.
Doctor Who is cool again, that was Russell's master plan.
Who back when? Reviewing all new Who there is. Who back when?
Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please.
Rose and Donna, Amy Pond, Rory, Martha and beyond. Join us on this odyssey, what other choice could there be than Who back when? Who Back When?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast.
Or Doc Pass.
So disrespectful, Leon. I mean, read the episode. This is N037, The Family of Blood. And with me in the studio today, to my left...
Hi, I'm Ponkin.
Yeah, and further around the table...
Hey, it's Nick Lely. How you doing, Podcast Land?
And we three are here to rock your earballs. Right, so...
Yeah.
And with that...
Intro over. Shall we mention we might have traffic in the background every now and then?
There might be some ambient noise distractions in this episode, because currently Oxford is hotter than the end of 42 right now, Oxford. It is at least 90 degrees or 35 degrees, whichever sounds hotter to you.
I'm burning!
whatever the line was.
Well, consequently, we've got the window open and cars are passing every now and then, so we'll see what happens. Anyway, apologies in advance.
So we're back at the Mexican standoff at the village, with the Doctor having to choose between his friend and his lover.
Surprise, surprise, they escape and the Family of Blood bring war to England a year early.
Several prescient Somme metaphors later, Mr. Smith is left with the Sophie's choice of sacrificing himself for the greater good or living a life of domestic bliss with Matron Daisy from space.
Barbarity ensues.
Beastgal
over.
You are welcome.
Aren't you just?
Before we launch into the episode, if you haven't heard the first part, if you're joining us for the first time, this is a two-parter, the first part being Human Nature, which we reviewed a few weeks ago.
So also, welcome to Who Back When.
Absolutely. Definitely go back and listen to that. That'll give you a good rundown of what our already thoughts and feelings were, what our reviews were.
And we said at the time that it was one of the best ones ever, and that as a double feature, this must be one of the best ones ever. We've now finally seen part two. How do you feel that part two stacks up?
So I've got a bit of a track record. If you look back through the stats page,
oh, this is true, yeah,
of tanking second parts. I didn't realise I knew this about myself, but the stats page on Who Back When is particularly great for voting patterns. And I,
you're welcome,
absolutely fucking ruined second buyers, and this is way as a much smaller jump off, if not actually, I'm pretty happy with resolutions here.
Really?
There are big holes.
Oh, there are huge holes.
But I think, in a bad way.
But not in the scarecrows.
No, quite.
Oh my god, we have to talk about the scarecrows.
We absolutely do. But I'll get to it in the review, but actually this is
the discrepancy is
much smaller.
Okay. Interesting. Drood?
Massive drop off.
Yeah, same here. Not massive, but certainly like a tangible one.
I repeat, massive drop off.
Okay, let's kick straight in, because the first scene is really cool.
It is, yes.
It is cool. And we're already halfway through from the first episode.
That's true.
The Ultimate Mexican Standoff. But then the very first thing that happens is little Bojo pops open the watch and it goes, Time Lords!
Yes. Is it just me or does the watch work differently all the time?
Literally every time.
Every time, right?
Every single time.
All of the times.
Yeah.
It does. It talks to him in very clear directions and then seems to have 15 different voices. Sometimes it has direction, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's of his own accord that he opens the thing.
Sometimes it gives him visions. On the other hand, he does have some sort of ESP, and maybe the visions, maybe that's why he's having these time board visions.
I think, because we said in the last episode, he's got the shinning.
Yes, he does have the shinning, but...
Don't forget the time where it just jet blasts down a corridor.
Oh, yes! That's in this one, right?
That's in this one.
Where, like, he basically uses it as some sort of weird telepathic flamethrower against a fucking child. That's cool. Well done, Love Actually.
Okay, because I know we're not doing plot by plot point, but that fucking scene where he was like, well, you know, I bet you're still in the body of a little girl. You know, how old is she? How strong do you think she is? I thought, wow, he's going to punch a little girl in the face. He's going to punch a little girl in the face. That's going to be a super brave choice by the BBC. Like this. He's gonna, but then he does the stupid opening a watch beam thingy.
Okay, yeah, I've got a question. In that scene, I mean, we're just jumping straight into whatever the middle of this episode. But if it had been one of the grown-up family members of Blurred, would they also have fled? Would they also have been, you know, flame thrown out of the corridor? Or is it just because this one inhabits the body of a girl?
Well, the run-up that he gives, you know, little Bojo.
Yeah, I remember exactly what
exactly
Love Actually
what
says.
Seems to...
But Love Actually is just a dude with fucking ESP. Like,
yeah,
what does he know?
He seems to indicate the idea that, yeah, it's because
she's in
she's
a...
Small.
Yeah.
But
that's bullshit.
That's bullshit. Actually, but then the biggest plot point, the biggest plot hole in this whole thing is that they've inhabited human form.
Wait, how is that a plot hole?
Why doesn't someone with the fucking Gatling gun just murder these people? They have guns.
Yeah.
The whole thing. I know we talk about why don't people get murdered all the time, but these specific old farmer man, little girl, boy seem very ripe for murdering.
Yep, and they are standing right in front of the school from where boys could snipe at them from one of 50 windows with their very effective lethal bullets.
They have a school Gatling gun.
I think that makes sense. Like, overall, I'm totally on board with all of that shit. And I think the only reason that they don't get sniped is the same reason we get that line after... Oh, wow, we are jumping around.
Well, that's what you wanted.
Yes, that is what I wanted, but... Oh, fuck it. Listen, check it out.
Just remember, be happy with how things are.
I am happy, but I'm also frustrated by this episode.
Okay.
So you remember when there's like an army of scarecrows like just tumbling into the school?
They're Helm's Deeping the school, yes.
Yes. The kids have shot all the scarecrows. We have to talk about that. And then afterwards, the first line uttered... the second line uttered. The first line is by the headmaster who goes, it's all just hay. They're just hay. And the second line is, so we didn't kill anyone. So that the kids will not have committed murder, so that on the BBC we won't have seen a show where there are children actually killing... We don't see child soldiers, basically. And for the same reason, we can't see them killing humans.
I think that line, or those lines, were to do with the... and there's a huge body of literature that everyone, you know, encouraged one to seek out, of accounts from First World War of children saying that they basically don't want to kill. Is it in the First or Second World War where everyone shot 6 feet above?
I imagine it was the First. The Second was much more mobile, wasn't it?
Yeah, that actually the idea that anyone wanted to kill, which was, you know, obviously the whole king country portion of it.
Sure, but that can also be said about any war and any person of any age.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But in this case, it
the
was...
conscription rates in First
and
World
you
War.
Could, and you could at the same time also say, well, a year later, all of these kids, the ones that survived anyway, which is, I think, all of them...
yes.
They then did go on to kill people, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, but we're not shown that. What we're shown is the kids not having killed anyone right now.
But that's
anyway,
that's
all this is to say, this is why I think they didn't ever give them the chance to aim at a human figure. They allowed them to aim at scarecrows, and that
but
was fine.
I reckon, I mean, my slight disagreement there is that that's the BBC's version of doing World War One for these kids.
Sure.
You know... As best they could.
Yeah.
As best
sure.
they could.
Besides the scene at the end where they're purely in a defensive shell-dodging role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other thing that scene raised for me was it made the Doctor's moral stance of, I can't shoot at these things that aren't being killed.
But I can happily allow children to do so.
Well, not only that, but just the fact that I have a moral objection to this. But actually, there's no moral objection to be had because they haven't killed anyone. So what is he doing? He's just not helping.
That's true. Doctor hates guns.
Yeah?
He does hate guns.
Yeah, even as Mr. Smith?
Apparently so. He does, you know...
Well, yeah, Mr. Smith is inside him. From Mr. Smith's pacifism comes the Doctor's hatred of guns.
Okay, let's talk Mr. Smith. Let's talk Mr. Smith for a second.
Okay.
Because in the first episode, he was this well-rounded character. In fact, we all liked that, you know, with Tennant playing Mr. Smith, I think, if memory serves.
Yeah,
the schoolmaster,
super well.
Very, doing that super well. And my that wanes for me a little bit in the second one because he turns into wet blanket super quickly. I'm not saying that he shouldn't because his, you know, the circumstance demands, you know, a visceral reaction. But he goes from well-drilled, you know, schoolmaster to, you know...
Yeah, I think that's both understandable and well-executed, though.
Yeah.
In the context of, holy crap, am I just a made-up person? Am I not real? Are all these memories that I have, are they just the story, in quotes, that he was telling Martha about in part one?
But the shooting part as well is where I'm sort of like, you know, the departure. Like I said, he's holding that rifle and not shooting and all that. Where are we supposed to be inferring there that that's the doctor poking through, or is that just Mr. Smith being a wetty?
I know, when the doctor finally shows up at the end of this episode, he is a massive sadistic badass.
Yeah. In multiple ways, not just the obvious ways, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, we will get to that.
I have problems, but okay, we'll get to that.
Well, I mean, this episode, dancing between two identities, polar opposites, there are a lot of grey areas, and I don't know, would more clarity have been better, or would we just be saying... What I'm saying is I don't think they executed it as well in this episode.
This so far for me is the second best Double Doctor, Scaramanga.
But how many others have you encountered on Huequen?
Are there more?
I was literally, as I finished the sentence, I went, have I encountered more?
Okay, but what I should have really said there, the better articulation is, this was good.
Yeah.
As a Double Doctor episode. Yeah.
Well articulated.
But not as good.
Not as good. Enemy of the World is... It's much better. Much, much better.
Yeah.
But it's also a different kind of Double Doctor, I guess.
Of course. Of course.
And also, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, check out our review of Enemy of the World. It's pretty good.
Patrick Troughton plays the Doctor
and Scaramanga. Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah.
So Martha, in the opening scene, has incredible agency.
Yes, she does.
Mm. Possibly the most poignant of New Who... agency. She is the last line of defense at this juncture.
Well, she's basically the doctor for this episode.
She's the doctor, right? At least
I think so.
Yeah, she is carrying the series.
Yeah,
and doing a remarkable job. She was super awesome in that opening scene and sort of subsequent.
Oh, there are so many things about the opening scene that really piss me off. Though.
Go him.
There are so many things, but seriously, you wanted to say something about Martha though in the opening scene, right?
Well, she absolutely is. Really quality. There is a lot of good acting in this episode from the women, I think.
Agreed, yeah.
I'd say that's where it ends.
Daisy from space acts everyone off the fucking screen.
Yeah, she does.
Absolutely. Very much.
Quite like she did in part one, as I recall.
Also, she amps it up. She's Oscar worthy in this episode.
Yeah.
Oscar? Golden Globe?
The last scene is... I would have... You know, I felt like I was watching a cinematic...
Yeah, give it a cinematic production. Release and give that woman an Oscar.
Yeah. Okay, well, the opening scene, though. So the following things really tick me off. Number one, everyone, both the family of Blurds and Martha, they have so many opportunities to just blast each other to smithereens and no one takes said opportunity. Martha's backed into a corner and is, I guess, as a good person, not about to kill them. Maybe she's thinking, oh, well, if I just... carry on running for like a month, they'll die of natural causes, right? That's the whole idea.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to shoot them. But then she's taken by a scarecrow who immediately lets her go and is still complimented by its superior officers, the family of Bloods.
I did think that. It's like well done, soldier.
No, not well done, soldier. Court-martial, soldier. That was terrible.
He was just following orders. Everyone knows that the generals in World War I mismanaged the whole thing.
Oh, no. Here. Let me trying to explain this out. They all have leverage, or at least the family of Blood need leverage. They know Martha knows where the doctor is actually hiding.
Yeah.
So shooting him gives away their biggest and best lead.
Possibly, but they try to draw him out of hiding later on with the TARDIS, whether or not Martha is in his company.
Those are just contributing lines
Martha
of inquiry.
And does Martha actually know where he is?
Well, that's the best shot. That's how they have to... They find the TARDIS, but that still doesn't really... But Martha seems to specifically know... I mean, they know that the Martha hangs out with the Doc. They've seen that. They get it.
It's possible.
I think that's the best explanation, right?
There's another question. If they had an army of scarecrows in their hundreds, why didn't they surround the hall at the end of the first episode? I mean, Bojo opened the window and there's a scarecrow out there. So why not get on that?
That's a super good point. They have so many scarecrows.
I assume they're in the reserve trenches.
Yeah. Also, so they live a finite amount and they're sort of 3 months. Well, they're a quarter off dying, right? They're 3 months off dying.
But 2 months have passed.
Yeah, so exactly. They only have 1 month left.
Okay, so 1 month left. Is it that they can only inhabit new things for 3 months? Or is it that They are just the finite amount of 3 months.
I was literally doing the maths in my head at the same time. It was 3 months from the point when... Holy shit, I didn't think about that. You're right. So is it 3 months after they take over someone? Couldn't they just jump from human to human?
I think 3 months is all they've got.
That's what
makes most
sense.
Unless they take over, what, like, in total?
In total.
Yeah, I think so.
Forever? Yeah. As in forever?
But that's
overall?
What I don't understand is that how have they been surviving hitherto?
Yeah.
Oh, well, they just got a finite Iceman. They just happen to be getting towards the end of it. I really
all
don't think
of them at the same time.
So in 3 months...
I know that there are two generations involved there.
Yeah, exactly. In 3 months, they've even procreated. Why not just keep... Like, what does it matter if they wait 3 months? Yeah, the older generation, Uncle Monty and What's-Her-Face, they're going to die.
I'll tell you what,
creepy student and tiny girl, they could, like, have an incestuous green light baby, or they could go and find some more blood family members.
Son of mine and daughter of mine are clones of the mother and father of mine. And they are prematurely senescent cell-wise.
I think the best explanation is that they have somehow encountered a finite cycle. Like, I don't know how they got to that point, but they've entered the last 3 months.
Wait, just to clarify, what you're saying is that you don't know how to explain it, but your explanation is that you don't know how to explain it.
I'm saying... that the explanation came before because it came before the hot open or the cold open or whatever we're calling it.
I think someone messed up. But the thing is, they messed up really well.
Super.
Because
well.
I didn't notice, I didn't think about this until you brought it up. Congratulations, you just saved another couple of
points up. Yeah. It did weird me out. But then I'm fine with the idea that, okay, they don't want to, let's say they don't want to island hop. They don't want to go 3 months to 3 months, human to human. They want the whole enchilada now. They want immortality or regeneration or whatever the fuck it is.
But, oh, all right. Is it actually, that makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay, since we're talking about the family of Blurred, can I ask, why does the sister still look like a creepy little girl?
What is the balloon about?
Yeah, not just that. How resilient is that balloon? Like, what is it made of? That balloon has been, like, all the balloons, on that string.
All the balloons post-war were made out of lungs.
Yeah, but this is pre-war.
Like inch-thick rubber.
Pre-war, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
All the walls, yeah, they were made out of immigrants' lungs.
Oh, for God's sake.
What?
I don't know. Let's move on.
That is the worst I've ever heard. Why is she skipping? Why is it, like, even when she's skipping into the school to, like, infiltrate it, we hear that really creepy music.
See, here's the thing. I think that undercuts the actual creepiness because it's so saccharine. And whereas, you know, little girls have always been creepy. Just they are a creepy trope. You know, the best example is The Shining.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the twin girls?
The twin girls, right?
Yeah.
But they don't skip. They don't move. They just stood there. And that's the creepiest fucking thing about them. That they don't look like gleeful little girls. Gleeful little girls aren't creepy. The ones that are stood there staring off into space with saucer eye, you know, pupils for eyes, they're fucking creepy.
Yeah. Also, the girls in the cupboard in space. Small world.
Oh, yes. Well done.
So creepy.
Well done.
So actually, I think that undercuts the whole message. The red balloon, the skipping.
I agree.
Creepy music. It does nothing. It doesn't actually creep me out. Do you know the two? So of the family of blood, of the four of them, the dad and the father of mine and daughter of mine are not creepy. But mother of mine and son of mine.
Oh,
are
son
super
of mine is
fucking creepy.
So yeah. And still so well acted.
But see, a mother.
What's his name again?
Forget.
Baines.
They do the heavy creeping work, definitely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But the mother of mine, there's a particular scene in the opening where Martha's asking whether Jenny has died. And because she's blind, she's been consumed. She's like, oh, all that screaming, you know, and then screamed really significant. And it's like, shit, that is fucking crazy.
Yeah, it's super sadistic. Yeah. Oh, yeah, actually, that was the line that confirmed what at least I was unsure of in part one, or in our first review. She does confirm they kill their, well, victims. Like, the people whose bodies they take over, they actually kill them.
Mm. Which is what leads us to the Oscar scene eventually. The Oscar scene hinges on the idea that people have died.
Yeah, true.
Absolutely. Yeah. On the subject of Mother of Mine...
Go for it.
Does anyone here watch Raised by Wolves by any chance?
No. Does anyone in podcast land watch Raised by Wolves? Write in and tell Drood.
If anyone in podcast land watches Raised by Wolves, Catelyn Moran's Channel 4 sitcom, the actress playing Jenny is also Ardella, the mother in the show. And she is a fox in that show.
Really?
You wouldn't think it, but...
Wait, hang on. Yeah. Who's Jenny? Mother of mine?
Yeah.
She a fox, as in, like, she's an actual fox.
Does she have a tail?
No. No,
oh,
she's
that's
not
too
a furry.
Bad. I kind of like that.
She's still a human being.
Okay.
She exudes a ton of authority. She's a very good actress in the show.
I'm sure she is. I completely believe that she is a good actress, having seen this.
Yeah, very good. So, son of mine, though, is creepiest. He's the creepy king.
He's the Banemeister.
Yeah. Which... Yeah. You know, the bit where he does the All Quiet on the Western Front chastising of his headmaster is...
A caning, sir? Yes, sir. No, sir. Not now, sir. Yada, yada.
Three bags full, sir.
Yeah.
Will they thank you?
That's super fucked up.
Question. In my notes, except my notes are in chronological order, somewhere in my notes, that point to me is an indication of memory. That to me is him remembering how the headmaster treated, not him... after having taken over Baines, but how he treated Baines.
Oh, no. So at some point, Jenny, mother of mine, does say there's some residual memories. They were close. You know, Martha and the doctor's close, hence the leverage that I was talking about. So they can access residual memory. It says so.
This was another question we had a couple of weeks ago. How far can they do this? And this almost immediately is explained in this episode. But it's not in the way I expected, where someone... shines a green spotlight.
Oh, also in my notes, where does this green light come from? It is some of the cheesiest sci-fi, like 1960s sci-fi horror effect ever. And I quite like that, but like, we're talking like, what's it called? Plan 9 from Outer Space is like that level of horror.
Do you know what it reminds me of?
No.
Just them communicating, like, nano, nano.
Nano, nano.
Nano, nano.
I'm wearing headphones, but otherwise I'd twist my ear.
That's what it reminds me of. Oh, actually, so another thing about the family of Blood and their technology that bothers me, super poorly designed gun. I mean, the gun looks very effective, but doesn't look handheld to me.
No, it looks like a worm. It looks like the memory worm that Capaldi handles later on.
It looks awful, awfully designed.
Terrible ergonomics. But then again, they don't know which kind of body they'll be inhabiting, right? So they kind of design them for human hands. They'll even design them for something else.
What do you think their true form is?
Exactly, boom shakalak. Their true form is like, their hand is like a cup holder that's like a hollowed out ice cream cone. That's what I'm talking about. They have ice cream cone cup holders.
They're Lego men.
Bingo!
Like Lego people.
They have Lego hands.
What's weird is that they don't revert to those forms in their eternal torture.
Yeah, they remain human.
I mean, the very, very finite flesh casing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the Doctor is said to freeze time for exactly one of them, Baines.
Yeah.
Scarecrow. The other... three?
Yeah, one of my last notes is, they'll live forever? Question mark? The mum would be torn apart. Uncle Monty would just die of natural causes. Someone surely will find Baines.
Yes!
Surely. And, like, conduct all manner of experiments on him. And if the girl is in every mirror, why would he visit her only once a year? Like, does he not look in other mirrors? No, he says, every mirror.
I visit her once a year.
Does he never look in mirrors?
Oh, no,
how do you trap someone in a reflection?
What's way worse than that? It's like... Oh, just out the corner of your eye. Like, she's like 4/5 of that mirror.
Yeah. But she probably knows exactly
like
which mirror.
Quite a lot of that fucking mirror, dude. That's not just out the corner. If you see something moving, it's like, because that's,
And why does she not constantly F with him?
That is ripping off, Roald Dahl.
The witches.
The witches.
Yeah.
That's what that's ripping
Ooh.
Off. Huge. That's exactly what I went to.
Yeah, same here. You know the witches?
I do know the witches, but from when
one
I was
of the kids, the witches traps
in a mirror,
in a painting,
painting,
in a painting,
yeah.
And the idea is that
oh,
the corner of your
yes,
eye,
yes, yes, yes. Oh, yeah. I talked with Miramu and I spoke about this that one thing like 2 days ago.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
is really
she
weird.
She lives on a farm and she's feeding her ducks. And
exactly.
Then in the other one, she's in the house and
and that's
weird.
What this is ripped off, but so badly.
Yeah, but if you were this girl, would you not constantly F with the Doctor?
Also,
like, every time he combs his hair, she'd just be there jumping up and down, distracting him.
Yeah. Oh, he'd like that, though, the sadistic bastard.
I mean, the other parallel that I saw, and my classical friend over here might be able to help me out, is all the Titans.
Ooh.
Right? Like Prometheus and all the other ones, and Atlas and such. And
well,
they were
definitely
given these weird... forevermore punishments like
Hulk, I see, yeah. Not mirror thingy.
Or the you know, the raven? Crow.
Pecking out the liver?
Yeah. Stuff like that.
Sisyphus.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, Sisyphus is rolling the boulder.
Yeah, boulder, yeah.
Prometheus had the...
That is Prometheus.
Yeah. Is it Prometheus? Prometheus? For stealing fire?
Yeah.
Right.
But the general point is that those were those sadistic, forever-type tortures.
But it's a classical education. Exact same,
well, not me, but...
Which fits?
Our future Tory Prime Minister over here.
Oh, wow, yes.
Which, I forgot about that joke.
I know.
Which fits into the Doctor's sort of godlike domain throughout this series, various divine references. He is now playing Zeus, assigning the Titans.
He becomes more and more Zeus-like.
But he's done this once before. It just dawned on me, he's done this once before in New Who. The three witches in Shakespeare code. Oh, he trapped them forever in a snow globe. He was like, you will be here forever looking out into the TARDIS, because now he just stores it in his closet.
Also, Zeus-like, he likes to bang everything.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
He even tries it on with this woman that he's technically just met.
Yeah. That's fine, though. Don't judge.
No, but, like, immediately tries to subsume the quote-unquote dead Mr. Smith.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, but I've got his eyes. Like, that's the... He's trying to bang at the wake. That's next level move.
He's trying to bone the widow. The double widow.
Yeah. I can do whatever he can do.
Yeah, exactly.
Way more experienced.
There's a little bit of him inside me, and if you like, you can have a little bit of me inside you.
He tried to bang the double glazed widow.
Oh, wow.
Oh, shit!
That's both good and terrible at once. I don't know. I'm so conflicted.
I went from terrible to genius. That's amazing.
Can we cut out the pause so it looks natural?
Oh, definitely. I laughed immediately, long and hard. But no, you're absolutely right. It's just like at the end of 42. He makes absolutely certain that there's no poon left for him in this scenario and goes back to Martha. Yes, time to leave.
Yeah, he doesn't even show any remorse, does he, really?
No.
Or the shame in it. He's just like, oh, this... So let's get to the Oscar-winning scene real quick.
Okay.
So Daisy, Matron Daisy, is fully amazing because she reacts how I want so many people that encounter the Doctor to react. Mm-hmm. This was part of the zenith of war criminal Doctor, torn Doctor, not actually the world's greatest moral compass, or the universe's greatest moral compass. He did and was called on some things. He's like, were you... turned up here and you brought death to our door.
Why has no one said this to him? I think people have said this to him. I mean, not necessarily, certainly not as well. But I think even on Who Back When, we've encountered something like this before. In New Who, someone surely has told him.
It might be because I'm feeling like it's not as well. And not as, because, so at the...
I swear someone at some point told him, you have caused death. Like, death follows you.
Victoria.
Certainly, yes. But that's almost a misunderstanding, I feel
like.
Because he did save the day and Queen Vicky was just being kind of daft.
How close they get to kissing that she delivers the blow.
Oh, I know.
So delicious.
She just nails that scene entirely, and he is being a massive dick, we should say.
He's being a massive dick, but I also don't think Tennant's necessarily delivering well.
Well, I think...
Really?
Jessica Hines is acting off the screen.
Yeah, that's what I think. I really think that. I think Jessica is...
But it's her scene. That's what... I agree with you 100%. She does a fantastic job, not just in that scene, but particularly in that scene. But it is... her scene.
Yeah, but you can have two actors bring it to the same scene.
Yeah, but all he has to do in that scene, I'm not saying that his job is easy, but all he has to do comparatively is not a lot. Like, he basically just has to go, oh man, I bet you're so wet. Oh, it turns out I'm an asshole, I better go. Like, he needs to do that, you know?
Yeah, but I didn't think...
I'm simplifying, obviously, you see what I'm saying.
I wanted
right?
to see more conflict. I wanted to see more earnestness in the way that he tried to woo. But actually, it turns out he was just like, well, I'm done now. We're good. Hey, everything's great, right?
Yeah. Do you think that maybe he's asking her to tag along as a companion out of... not because he wants to take the express train to Plowtown, like, but because of... maybe out of pity in a way. Like, he wants to...
Now
he realizes he's taken everything from this woman and he wants to give a little bit back in the form of this adventure, right?
I think I felt that in 2007.
Mm-hmm. 7 or 8.
7 or 8. Didn't feel that this time. I felt like Pound Town. Because he talks about I have his eyes and shit, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. That's true. That's not companion.
We could give it a go.
Yeah.
All yeah, actually, nonsense. That's not at all the case. No, he proves himself to be a complete dick in this scene.
And massively superficial.
Yeah. Very much so.
And what I'm saying is, if his character wasn't constructed like that, which Tennant, as an actor, must have some control over, the Doctor's supposed to be a man of incredible charisma.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm going on Daisy's reaction and being like, of course you'd reject him because she's acting that rejection and that complexity so well. But at the same time, he's not very alluring.
No, not at all. And she's just, she finally dared to love someone again, and then she just lost that dude. It doesn't matter that they look the same. And plus, she lost him because, in effect, the Doctor killed him. Or, like, made him kill himself.
But see, the greatest thing about this all is Jessica Hines needs to do way more period dramas.
Yeah.
She nailed register, timing, inflection, all of it sounded, in my head, exactly what 1913 sounded like.
As I was rewatching the episode earlier today, it struck me, or I think I remembered, that there's one of those escape from reality scenes in Spaced where she does that. Is that not the case? Drew, do you know Spaced inside out? Is there not a scene where she is suddenly a bit more posh than she is normally? Perhaps it's slightly out of... No?
I can remember her being Philippa Forrester.
I fucking love Philippa Forrester.
Well, regardless, I agree. She did a fantastic job and we want to see more of it. So well done, Daisy, from Spaced.
Please come back.
Yes.
Yeah, and there was a lot of acting to do in that scene as well. And like Nick says, on all these various levels, she didn't put foot wrong. It would have been something really easy to just blunder through. But she was... I watched the episode twice, and only the second time around did I get the full extent of how well she was acting. Because there's stuff to take in on repeat performances there. She's really that good.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay, so what I'd really like to talk about is the... I don't want to say the reincarnation. What am I going to go for? The repossession of the Doctor.
Okay.
Okay, because I was going to nominate a different topic. But let's go there.
I talked about this a lot in the first episode. And having remembered it in 2007, 2008, of being deeply unsatisfactory.
Yeah. You were right, by the way. You were right. In part one, what did you say? You said, like, oh, this is an incredible disappointment.
I said, whatever you think the... or at least I was alluding
to. It's going to be...
It's going to be worse.
Yeah. You were right, by the way.
Deeply unsatisfactory.
And not just that. They don't even explain everything. I mean,
they don't show it.
Well, now, see, here's the thing.
They don't show it at all. It happens off screen. It's an aside. It's a Shakespeare scene where it's like, oh, and they just won the war.
Now, in 2007 and 2008, I didn't realise it was an aside. Or at least now, in 2016, I'm thinking maybe it was an aside. What I had thought at the time was like, oh, this was all nonsense. The watch meant nothing. You could have re-inhabited yourself at any given point. You've just picked the best and most dramatic version to do so. In 2016, I understand the idea that on the way to sacrifice himself, or seemingly he's playing the dunce, and on the way to the ship, he's re-inhabited himself. That's how I read it now.
Yeah, it has to be.
That's not how I took it at all. Here's what I reckon happens. First of all, let's just acknowledge he is definitely the Doctor, not Mr. Smith, when he stumbles into the spaceship. He is pretending to be Mr. Smith, right?
Absolutely.
Yes. He is already the Doctor. But do you think that he is already Gallifreyan? Like, is he is psychologically the Doctor, intellectually the Doctor, but do you think he's biologically the Doctor? Because they sniff the air and they go, still human, which indicates that maybe he didn't.
That's probably what I was thinking in 2007.
Right? But then at the same time, in this scene, we have that one argument for the fact that, okay, so intellectually he's basically inhaled the yellow fairy dust from the fob watch, right? But he hasn't stepped into the... What was it called again?
The Chameleon Arch.
Bingo. Such a shit name.
Why does everything a fucking arch or an arc? Or
branding!
If the Time Lords had invented that gun that they're using, it would have been the Shooty Arch.
The Shooty Arch. Yeah, you're right. So, but since he hasn't stepped into the Chameleon Arch, he's biologically still a human. But in the same scene, he also says it's a form of olfactory...
Misdirection.
It's like ventriloquism.
Bingo.
But with the nose. Now, why would he need to do that if he weren't fully...
Exactly.
Biologically a Time Lord?
Exactly. Exactly. So what happens? I'm absolutely sure that he is the Doctor intellectually when he climbs in there. I reckon at some point he just inhaled the fairy dust. He became it intellectually, and then later on, blah, 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 in the same montage where we get to see him exert his incredible revenge on the family of Blood, allegedly forever, there's one cutscene that we don't get to see where he steps into the Chameleon Arch, or rather he puts it on his noggin, and he's turned back into a Gallifreyan chap.
So what point do you think he's sniffed the fairy dust?
Mr. Smith in the cabin, in, not the cabin, the, yeah.
The Cartwright's house.
They exactly, Cartwright's. Which again, fucking
super dark. Yeah. So dark. I reckon the conversation that he has, with that last chat that he has with Daisy from space, where she goes, can we have the room please? And gives him a hug and he's about to cry. I reckon that scene ends. We don't see it, but that scene ended with him going, yes, I will do this. I'll save the world. I'll sacrifice myself.
See, the great thing about that is that and on the second viewing, actually got better for me because in the two, I just didn't believe those writers had that level of gall and subtext. Because nothing hitherto has had that much brilliant subtext. So we'd have to imagine for ourselves the ultimate sacrifice scene for Mr. Smith.
Yeah.
And that happens off screen. And that, has that ever, anything quite like that in Doctor Who, in New Who, certainly happened off screen, that significant?
I would love to believe that the writer's motivation was to make you think about that subtext later, rather than, we don't have a way for the Doctor to become a Time Lord again, shall we just sweep it under the rug?
Also, we spunked our budget with this invisible spaceship.
Oh yeah, because it costs so much money to have him put a fucking colander on his head and scream for a little bit. Yeah.
Also, but the TARDIS has been trapped because that seemed to raise some tension earlier, but now we've written ourselves into a corner. Can we
put Uncle Monty in the chains that were forged in the heart of a dwarf star?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Anyway, wait, hang on. There's one more thing about the Oscar-winning scene.
Oh, God.
There's one more thing in the Oscar-winning scene, which I guess maybe lends credence to the fact that he does willingly sacrifice himself in that house. And that is, but it's at the same time a bit of a plot hole. Because he, up until that point, does not believe that the Family of Blood can actually destroy the world or the universe. Like, he wanted at first to give them the Fobwatch, right? But then Daisy from space suddenly just goes, oh, I just finished your book. I didn't read it to the end before, which is utter nonsense. And it turns out his book ends with, oh yeah, if they get the Fobwatch and they take over all his Gallifreyan powers, then they will reign supreme and destroy the universe forever. He's actually written this. And it wasn't just, as we established in part one, it wasn't just like a fever dream that he then promptly forgot. He sat down and actually intellectually formed a narrative.
Although
that culminated
in
that.
When we actually saw the plates, or, you know, of those scribblings, they did look like
a child with problems produced them. Yeah. But still, surely he must know that, right?
I mean, yes.
He must be aware of all the problems.
If it was like, hey, I wrote this weird dream about a family of blood, and then these people say they're the family of blood, I don't see the connection.
There's something about a Fobwatch. Everyone's trying to pawn this fucking Fobwatch on me.
Yeah. The family of blood wants to take over the universe. This family of blood say that they'll take over the universe. I'm sure it's completely different.
We've been hidden. And my companion, Martha, who's a lot like my maid, Martha...
I think it's fairly straightforward to figure out temporally within the plot where the Doctor changes back.
It's in the house.
Well, it only seems to be a question of degree. It's after he has the one-to-one with Daisy and before he's in the spaceship.
Yeah, but those are sequential scenes, are they not?
Yes, yes. And absolutely it happens in that instance.
I mean, there's a transitory scene that we don't see.
That's... Yeah, but do you think it's by Mr. Smith summoning his courage that he literally summons the Doctor? Or do you think that Mr. Smith summons the courage to look into the Fobwatch and thus the Doctor flies back into him?
Now, I reckon it's the latter. I thought the former in 2007.
I don't think it's that deep, man.
Well, actually, I thought the former, because I was trying to rewrite what was shitty. I was just like, did he just become the Doctor? What was the fucking Fobwatch about? What is this olfactory misdirection? What the fuck are you talking about?
Well, the olfactory misdirection thing is full bullshit.
Full bullshit. So I couldn't tie together all those knots as a, you know, like I said, cracking on for 10 years.
Well, neither could Paul Cornell, but okay.
Yes, quite. And that was the big sort of hole for me. I'm like, oh, was this frivolous then? Were you just hiding frivolously?
No.
Because you could have...
No, exactly. He hasn't been the Doctor this whole time. I mean, he changed biologically. He wiped his memory. It stands to reason that that was all authentic.
But could he have changed back at an earlier point?
Just by being courageous?
By being... No. I don't really know why.
I think there was some late... Oh, sorry, go for it.
Well, let me throw another spanner in the works. The army of the Family of Blood are about to wreak havoc upon the school.
Yeah.
But little girl Green communicates with the people outside, with the Nanunanu, saying, wait, don't do it yet. The Doctor is playing some sort of trick. Now, this is never resolved, as far as I'm aware.
I know. I think...
Is it the trick the Fobodge?
She knows exactly where in the house the Doctor is, but she can smell the fairy dust from the Fobodge in a different part of the house.
Possibly, but Smith... They've smelled Smith a lot during episode one, and he hasn't smelt with the Doctor at
and
all.
And actually smelt the Fobodge in the village hall.
Yeah. Wait, yeah. What the fuck? Why aren't they already chasing the boy?
5 seconds into
the
episode...
They saw the goddamn boy with the fob watch.
5 seconds into the episode, the watch shouts, "Time Lord!" Is that not obvious enough for you?
And then it's like, "Keep me safe. I'm shy."
Yeah.
Yeah, not yet. It's not time just
and
yet.
And then later on, it's, "Lord of Time!" Because that's completely different.
I mean, that's the bullshit. That's the bullshit they kept throwing me. It's like, it's not time yet. Now it's time. Now I'm ready to come back. It's like... This seems, and this plays into the Oscar-winning scene, because, that you know, Matron Daisy essentially says, this was on your whim that you came here and people were murdered. This is part of your ego trip, or at least part of your inability to really empathise with people with your actions. You just come and do and leave. So he's, you know, the idea that he doesn't necessarily, you know, it's timing. It's not actually imperative, it's timing, because he wants to come at the most dramatic and...
Right, I see that. And he doesn't deny it, and he doesn't show any contrition whatsoever.
In the very same Oscar-winning scene, when he doesn't want to die because he's missing out on this life with Daisy from Spaced.
The Last Temptation of John Smith.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. They both hold the fob watch, and they suddenly... We get to see this montage of their potential life together.
Oh, yeah, and this was the recap from episode one, which we thought, it might go in that direction.
Exactly, yeah.
Dream sequence.
Which, by the way, nicely done, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, I just felt lied to. I felt used.
Yeah, but some people like to be used. What springs to mind, there's an episode of TNG called The Inner Light, which is where Picard gets his flute from. Do you remember this episode?
I know the flute. I can't quite remember the origin.
Okay, so Picard is, like, blasted by some sort of weird alien wibbly-wobbly thing.
And now I play the flute.
And he wakes up on an alien planet where...
Make it blow.
Yes! It's a beautiful episode, you guys. So he wakes up on this alien planet where, like, the identity of Picard is just a distant dream of his, very much like the Doctor is to Mr. Smith in Human Nature. And he has this whole life where, among other things, he gets married, he becomes a father, he becomes a grandfather, he plays the flutes, yada, yada, yada. And he, as in, he's not a human, he's a member of some completely different species. And then, boom, he wakes up and he's Picard again. And it's actually everything, his entire life has just, this whole life that he just led on a different planet, that was just a microsecond as he was being shot by this energy thing. But he just experienced like 30 years in a microsecond. Spoilers for TNG, by the way.
Like, all this week on Who Back Generation.
It's a tangent, but it's worth it.
It's good. It's a good tangent.
It's there are so many parallels between that episode of TNG and this episode of Doctor Who. You have the whole Smith and Doctor thing, but then you also have this little scene where you don't get to live together, but here, you sort of do. Like, vroom. Do you think that she also experienced that?
She seems to. She indicates something about her. Yeah. Something in the language.
Because I wasn't so sure, but I know that he did. And at the very least, he had it, which makes it even more Picard-y for me.
Another way in which Jessica Hines has the run of the Doctor in this episode.
Yeah.
She can maintain an accent when she's acting with emotion.
Oh, do you have soundbite references?
Just pick one. I mean, anywhere. From any minute, any second in the episode, the Doctor is talking loudly in just, I don't know, guttural Cockney English. It's just, I know he's Scottish anyway, so he's already doing an accent, and he's putting an accent on top of that, so fair play to you, David Tennant. But he does not sustain it for this episode. And as he goes to Wet Blanket as well, he becomes increasingly modern.
Oh, interesting.
And that, for me, really took away it. Fed into the sort of grey area between the Doctors, because the John Smith that we liked in episode one is sort of draining away as Tennant can't hold it together. Disappointing.
Okay.
I have more holes.
Go for it.
Well, this is just more fucking annoyance. So when Smith Doctor wanders into the spaceship, all bumbly and fob-watchy and wet, and falls over and presses all the buttons.
Yeah.
Why doesn't any of those masters of intergalactic flight go, oh, those were important buttons.
Oh, no, no. I think the reason for that is that the end of this episode is, as in, of the Family of Bloods run, is utter garbage.
It's,
that
it's
scene so is so, well, because so it's poorly so crafted.
I mean,
I'm just going to fumble on lots of green lights that all have the same sound effect. Oh, no one's going to notice.
They don't have any sound effect. They don't have any alarm.
Yeah, they do. And the thing is, I don't know, I couldn't build my car, right? That's not something I could do. I don't know all the things that happen in an internal combustion engine or all the lights, right? But if we're driving along the motorway and you as a passenger try to put it into reverse, I might fucking notice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why don't they notice?
Imagine that passenger also tried to put it into reverse 40 times.
Yeah.
Why don't they notice that, like, because here's this
because
panel
it's
that controls the flow. I don't know, or some, like he said, some mumbly bullshit, right? But just don't let him touch. I mean, I wouldn't let, even if I didn't think you were my enemy, I still wouldn't let you touch these things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Stride towards him, hold him up against the wall, take the watch off him, boom, you're done.
Yeah.
And
shoot
also,
him.
Yes.
Because actually, if you know that it's in the watch, you don't need the body anymore.
Yeah, and they say, don't think this has saved your life rather than just getting on and killing.
Yeah, but maybe they just want to be sadists and torture him a little bit later on.
Maybe.
However, but that being said, I agree with you. But yeah, what are you going to do? That's another thing in this episode that's just pulling the rating down.
We are too big a fans of murder for a BBC.
Well, no, we expect them to be consistent with how they...
Yeah.
Summarily murdered.
Exactly.
People so far.
Exactly. We are fans of consistency.
This is definitely one of the.
You're a fan of murder.
Bloodiest, non-bloodiest serial so far in New Who. There's a lot of fucking death, but not much blood.
No, no one dies.
Whisper smoke at best.
Oh wait, no.
Loads of people die.
Yeah,
Mr. Phillips, the head. They all die.
And actually, you hear a load of screams and bombs and who are they shelling?
Well, just the village.
The
just
village.
The
yeah, that's another thing in my notes. Does that not, like, drastically alter history? Do they think that someone's bombing?
We covered a whole lot of stuff up. Basically everywhere between, like, 1850 and 1950. It's loads of stuff.
Including the bombing of some village. Okay, whatever.
During between
sure.
1914
no,
and
sure.
1918.
I'm perfectly
worry,
happy.
Fine.
Perfectly happy to believe that.
Can I just say one more thing about the bullshit final scene? When they are running...
Yeah.
Across the field, our alarms not blaring and wailing and going off.
Oh, all the alarms that they set up?
To warn them about when the ship might be being sabotaged and about to blow up. That would have been useful a minute earlier. No?
Why aren't they alerted to someone putting their car in reverse at 70 miles an hour?
Yeah, in 40th reverse gear.
Why are there a bunch of buttons that, when all pressed...
In a row...
In a row, lead the ship to self-destruct.
So he has
in
any to given around the room and go bloop 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 over here and bloop 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 over.
Oh, did you put your car into first gear and then second gear and then first gear again? I'm sorry, that detonates your car. I'm sorry, that's just something that we didn't think of.
Now, what he's doing is he's putting the spark plug in the petrol tank. That's what's going on there.
Yeah, but that's because there's a button that takes the spark plug and puts it in the metal in the petrol tank. Oh, okay.
Sorry. On behalf of Paul Cornell.
Can we talk about the scarecrows for a little bit?
Do you mean the scarecrows? Held together by molecular fringe animation, sir. Aren't I good at science, sir?
Why are you so good at this?
You are so good. I made a note of the soundbite time. Don't
need
it. That
need
was
it.
Infinitely superior. Oh, well done. Well done. Even the grimace was there. Oh, Baines, what an amateur. Okay, so...
Okay, how do scarecrows work?
Yeah, in part one, we had the conversation about how Uncle Monty goes up and pulls out the guts, the straw guts of a scarecrow.
Yeah.
And it's actually just straw. And what's the space again? Baines explains that it is. I'm not going to try to do it because I could never do it as well as you did. But he explains that it's basically just, it is animated hay, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's made to look like hay anyway. It's made to take on the shape of whatever, the characteristics of hay. He even pulls off the arm of one of the soldiers in actually what is a pretty fun scene, because the soldier just sort of looks at the stump and he's like, oh, that's kind of weird.
Didn't see that coming. I wouldn't have stood here.
Why then can the kids shoot bullets at these scarecrows and have them fall down. Like, they fall down like it's that scene in Platoon. Like, just, riddled with bullets.
Okay.
Explain.
Right. So, I'll give you the post-prod rewrite and the writing reason.
Okay.
I'm gonna go for. The post-prod rewrite is that it's like T2.
So it.
This is what you said last week. Very prescient.
I know, but that's just because I wanted to make a reference to that Dyson machine.
Okay. I think it's like T2.
You think so? That is just, like, they're basically knocked out.
They're knocked out. They're coming back.
But the only reason they come back, I think, is because later on, the Baines. Why do I keep forgetting his name? Baines. Cries out. And that reanimates them.
Yeah, molecular fringe reanimation. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And then the reason that they did that is because we haven't really touched on properly, really got into the World War One motif. So this is those writers trying to address in some way, I don't know what everyone in podcast land right now is feelings right now into World War One, but as a British person, it's so baked into our national psyche. So that's their way of doing... you know, the Somme, Flanders Field, without having to do the Somme.
Yes.
Yeah, PG from the Watershed. Yeah.
Well, no. Yes, definitely. But they are made of straw. How do you explain this? What do you think went through the writer's mind?
I think they were thinking more about the children, tears in their eyes, feeding a machine gun than they were thinking about the logical consistency of strawmen. Because that is a fucking emotionally raw.
Agreed.
Scene. Yes.
Agreed.
That really got to you, right? That
very
got
well
to me.
Shot, very good build up.
The kids, yes. The strawmen being shot.
So I think the idea is that you're supposed to focus on the kids. Supposed to focus on the kids, not the straw. And also strawmen, you know, I know that's more of a rhetoric point, but it is, you know. I mean, it would only have been better if they were toy soldiers.
Yeah, tin soldiers.
Tin soldiers, that's it, yeah.
You know what I think? Molecular fringe animation, it's basically not even that good imaginative way of saying there's some basic force field holding them together. You shoot enough bullets at them, the force field breaks down. He says reanimate.
Or if you're a corpulent farmer and you just grab some of him, then that's fine.
I was literally going to say that. Or if you grab 4/5 of him.
Yeah, they can take a few bullets. They can take a couple of fists, but, you know, beyond that,
I think
the hole's too big.
The T2 explanation is probably the best you're going to get here, Leon. I would worry. But that's what that was. What it was doing this song. Now, let me talk about that. So little Bojo and his shinning and his...
Boris is back!
And his fob watch that now tells his death clock.
Yeah.
Death clock.
Yeah,
I've got to say, and I still am emotionally cut up by the you know, the guy, the kids feeding the machine guns through tears. That was fucked up. So undercut with him walking through no man's land, because I know as a, you know, having done this stuff at school, there were children essentially fighting that war, 16, 17 years old.
15 years old.
Yeah, quite. But there was something about Love Actually's Bojo that just didn't sell it for me.
Mm-hmm.
When he was doing the carrying his mate, you know, he's like, that's an order.
Who is the guy, right?
Oh, that's his mate.
Not his mate. He's the dude who's like, translate my Catullus.
Yeah, David Cameron.
Yeah, exactly. It's David Cameron.
But David Cameron, you know, what I'm saying is that little Bojo has nothing about the whoever did the makeup, whoever coached him through the fucking acting of that scene. It was such an afterthought. They were just like, just walk through this and seem like you're scared. They completely, like, in the way that the going over the top for Blackadder scene was, you know, makes you want to cry.
Iconic.
It made that portion where they dodged the bomb.
It was reminiscent for me of the school play that Max does in Rushmore.
Yes.
Like, let's just cram every war stereotype into this one scene.
Oh, I'm not going to make it.
Exactly. No, this is what I told you all those years ago, except this was a year ago. Less than a year ago, because one full year ago, you were a total dick to me and I never would have told you that would survive.
And at some point, now he's become this kid's officer.
Yeah, obviously.
It's an order.
Obviously, because he's a good guy, so he's better, i.e. he's now the superior officer.
Basically, what I'm saying is that kid was unable to do, you know, and not that he couldn't have ever done or couldn't do now, but quite clearly at the state wasn't given
the right direction or the right lines.
Yeah.
Nor was David Cameron.
No.
Who is going to deliver the, no, leave me, I'm done for? Who's going to deliver that well and convincingly?
Well, quite.
It's just been done too often.
And it's not like...
to death, one might say.
It's not like Love Actually can't act either, because I actually thought when the TARDIS left, he actually acted better than most other people at something that wasn't there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. And I like that scene.
The scene with the little girl before he actually lasers her in the face with Dr. Watch.
I hate that girl.
That little exchange is actually really good. It's kind of tense.
No, it's not.
No. Before that. So when he gets to those, like, you know, when he says, you know, I bet you, you know, I bet you're still just... in the body of a little girl. I'm thinking, he's going to rush her. That's going to be awesome.
No,
and then he doesn't.
You know what really took it? It took me out of that scene.
Yeah.
It was, how the shit do you, man-child, know anything about how aliens have taken over other human bodies? And how have you, are you a fan of science fiction novels? Like, have you read a bunch of Penny Dreadfuls and that's why you know all this shit?
He's got the shinning.
And when did you last see a girl? You've been at a boys' school for, what, 3 years now?
Exactly. Like, actually, what's running through his mind is like, bone.
Bone.
I'll hold your balloon.
Let's definitely not make...
They're both the same age. It's okay. We're talking about him.
Yeah, they're contemporaries. It's fine.
I want to bow out of this right now.
Okay. Where do you go from there?
I think I'm done. Is there anything left to talk about?
Actually, yeah, since we have brought him up, let's just soundbite his description of the Doctor.
He's like fire and ice and rage. He's like the night and the storm and the heart of the sun.
Stop it.
He's ancient and forever. He burns at the center of time and he can see the turn of the universe.
Stop it, said stop it.
And he's wonderful.
Yeah, he smells the turn of the universe. He craps thunder and shits lightning.
What's with the constant... And I feel like we've had this before. What's with the picture of the Doctor with rain and fire? What's that from?
Oh, no, that was directly taken from the Christmas special.
Yeah, exactly. And they just love that fucking bit, don't they?
Yeah, because they had to, like, rent fire equipment.
And rain.
They rented rain.
Do you know how much rain
We're costs? In England. BBC going out of business because they keep renting rain.
In Wales.
Stop seeding clouds, it's fucking Norfolk. Oh my days.
Okay.
I would also say, Bojo, he dodges that one shell, he's good for the rest of the war.
I was thinking, the other thing I was thinking, what we learn at
so
school,
good.
And again, I don't know about you guys in podcast land and how much you know about First World, but the average life expectancy once a soldier went over the top into No Man's Land was literally seconds. It was like 19 seconds.
Hmm.
So yeah.
That's actually where we get to see the... Is that the only... No. Yeah, the only, like, quote-unquote death, the only non-vaporized death of this episode is because they get out of the way, someone else buys it.
Did someone actually buy it?
Yeah, someone buys it and that's in.
Well, the thing is, and what Drew said is like, there's still quite a lot of killing to be done. Like,
yeah. I mean, this is 1914 now. You still got the Somme, Passchendaele, Ypres. You got it all.
Well, this guy made it. Actually, we didn't talk about that. We get to meet him as an old dude.
Who looks nothing like...
Like Love Actually?
I don't know who...
Oh.
I could suspend my disbelief.
Yeah, me too.
He became him after 70 years.
And he did nothing but... He spent like 55 years eating potatoes.
And becoming a potato.
And growing eyebrows.
Eyebrows, yeah. Potatoes will do that too. And then he meets the Doctor. And the Doctor's all young. And he meets Martha. He sees Martha, and Martha's all young. And he's like, fuck you guys. I stayed here. I went to war. I'm still not disillusioned.
Yeah, you did not grow old as I, who was left, grew old.
Also, yeah, quite. Yeah.
Exactly.
That is a very...
I mean, so, he even tells them...
I mean, worse than that, everyone's like, so I went to war as a, what was he, 15, 14, right?
Yeah.
And then I probably went to war again.
In World War II. A lot of people did.
Yeah.
He will have been right age.
Although, wait. Can we go a little darker? He's in a wheelchair at this ceremony. It may not be out of old age. He may actually have been crippled in the First World War and not had to go to the Second World War, or he was crippled in the Second World War. That may not be natural causes.
Well, in that case, he would throw the watch at him and say, fat lot of good this
exactly.
was.
Exactly, and he still doesn't resent the Doctor. I mean, when he... That scene, that is actually a lovely scene, where he says goodbye...
My heartstrings were tugged. Mm.
As were mine, but I'm referring to a different scene. Oh. The lovely scene of when he says goodbye to Doc and Martha as a boy, and he's like, well, I mean, you could die as well, gallivanting around time and space with that dude. I'm like, that's a lovely scene, but like, wouldn't you rather risk dying gallivanting around time and space than risk dying in a war that is fought for completely, you know, reasons other than your own personal interests?
It is always odd how nobly, I mean, I guess it's because of the juxtaposition of how fucking ignoble the reasons, from what I can understand, for the First World War were versus those that fought in it. So that's that weird...
Or could it be that because he used the shinning before and he saw himself in the war, he must go to war?
I think he in fact says something to that effect. Of
really?
Like, you know, this is my... This is...
Fixed point in time.
Yeah.
Ah, there we go. So maybe that's it.
Fuck you. Fixed point in my ass.
Also, question. Did the Doctor really save his life in those trenches? I feel like he didn't. You can't say that, oh, the Doctor gave me a watch and I knew exactly what time it was going to be. He could have just got a different watch. And also, he had already used the shinning and he knew exactly when and where he was going to be.
I mean, also, and I know conscription was crazy, you know, the per capita death rate was crazy, but... Hey, I've got this watch. I'm going to be in this field. And I'll be at this time. I'm going to pick an entirely different fucking field.
Fixed point in time.
Yeah. I'm going to be like,
oh,
hey,
oh, there we go.
Don't send me this Somme. Let me go Belgium.
Wait. No. It's I'm going to be at the Somme. But wait, I recognize that mud.
I'm going to be over here with the tangerine fields.
I need to be closer to that pile of mud.
You guys are funny. I'm going to see what's happening at the pyramid stage.
Well, no, he identifies it purely by the time. He's like,
yeah,
well, it's going to drop on me at this point in time. I better look up because I haven't been doing that because I'm only being shelled. But whatever.
I mean, I dodged one shell, but don't worry about this wall of bullets.
Yeah.
That's super dark, but that's basically the reality of...
Yeah. Reviews.
Well, no, I think...
Oh, there's something else?
I think we've actually undersold Martha and Daisy by focusing on the first scene where Martha is. And
oh yeah, we've missed out some big
the Daisy scene, because they appear together, and Martha rattles off the bones in the hand, and Daisy is torn between, well, should I stay racist? I think I'll just leave. That's probably the best thing for me to do at this point.
I like that. Yeah, she's quite clearly confronted with all these things. Like, it's like, well, we've seen people vaporize, but black people.
But you're black.
Doctors.
No, I don't think so.
Now I know.
Very
you silly.
Nice try, black woman.
I've seen animated scarecrow soldiers. And, yeah, like I said, people have been turned into dust, but...
You're a little dark. Pretty sure my friend's dream of being a Time Lord is actual truth.
But Martha is given credit for being able to read, at least, in that episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That episode, in that scene.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you read it in a book somewhere.
And there's just so many great Daisy scenes. I mean, this is sort of veering into review territory, but where she challenges the Doc to tell her about Nottingham. And
that is very good.
Yeah.
That's incredibly good.
There are a lot of great scenes in this episode.
In that scene, and in some other scene in which he's perplexed at how little he knows himself, I got Total Recall vibes.
Mm.
No?
Yeah, I see that. I think, Tennant's best work in this as well is his Sophie's Choice moment, is the one that he's, you know, he's sort of wrangling and you know, aren't I a good man? Or isn't... You know, Mr. Smith, a good man, all that sort of stuff. I believed it, man. I was a little weepy. Not really weepy.
We've done this to death now.
Okay,
though,
let's
I think.
Do this. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
As in that scene, sorry.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Yeah. But there's just where she's saying, John Smith, he would know that boys going into battle was wrong. He's training them on the machine gun yesterday. I mean,
that's a good point.
Yeah, no, actually,
ringing the bells,
I don't think so.
Calling them to arms.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, and the headmaster. I really liked how the headmaster. You think a lesser Doctor Who episode would be like in the face of Baines going, well, of course you're wrong to send them to war. What will they say to you? And the headmaster turns around and says, I have been a soldier, mate. I know what this is all about, and I would go back and do it tomorrow, because that's how people actually were.
Yeah,
back then. And
the line, I used my dead mates for sandbags, is going to live long in the memory.
Yeah.
I was in South Africa.
Yeah, you can bet that that was probably taken from someone's memoirs or horrific journal of the time.
Mm.
And I appreciate that being
incredibly evocative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two more things before we jump into reviews.
Oh, okay.
One, next time, blink. Seconds of that. 5 seconds of that preview, and I was wide-eyed and not blinking. It's just directly affecting.
I cannot wait. Nor can I. I am really, really excited.
Yeah. The second thing is, I'm going to update something I said about 42.
Oh!
You know how we argued about how the Beatles pre-download question could still be possibly be relevant in the 42nd century?
Yes.
Well, Drake has now been at number one in the UK for 14 weeks, because the charts are sorted by streaming now, instead of physical sales. So basically, the charts are grinding to a halt, culture is grinding to a halt, and so everything I said is true.
I'm happy for you and sad for us.
I did not understand that train of thought, but okay.
Well, just a song that nobody's even buying anymore is just continuously at number one, because people just listen to the same thing over and over again. Culture is eating itself, there is nothing new getting through. Honestly, there was an article on the BBC News website about it, which is good enough for me, saying how, you know, nothing new is going to get
anywhere
anymore.
I mean, that argument holds weight if it wasn't that 15 weeks ago, that song didn't exist to us.
True.
So that was in itself new.
Get back to me 15 centuries from now. We'll see where we are.
Okay. If Drake is still number one in 3028, fair play. It's a good song.
Yeah. Reviews.
Okay, do you want me to go first? Because you always complain about...
No, go for it. I do feel bad for having complained that time, but...
You should God do. Damn.
I don't feel that bad.
I know you don't. I feel a little bad. You just say sorry all the time.
No, I feel a little bad. I feel a little bad. I feel like maybe I overreacted a little.
So that's your smile.
What smile are you talking about?
You can hear yourself smiling, for goodness sake. Anyway, the writing was definitely a step down from last time, in my opinion. Whereas... In Human Nature, each character had a space carved out for them. This week was all about action, but that action was muddled. It was confused. They were in the school. The doctor was playing a trick. They were out of the school. Was the doctor's trick that he wanted to get into the spaceship? That seems pretty contrived. And only Martha and Daisy came out of this episode as well as they did last time. The doctor had his moments, but he was also partly a bellend, which I suppose was him returning to his doctor form, but I don't like that form. I liked Human Nature, John Smith. I would say that Daisy was so good. If we can't have a black doctor, Idris Elba, like everyone seems to want, then let's have Jessica Hines be a new female doctor. Why not? She'd be my second choice. She stole every scene she shared with Tennant. The family grew increasingly annoying. I thought they didn't have necks as aliens, so they basically just twisted their heads around, and that was weird. They blew up the village. They were a bit vindictive, but nobody... got killed. None of the boys got killed. The head, well, every kid's dream is their headmaster gets killed. Mr. Phillips, who the fuck was he? So, yeah. The episode almost clicked. It's not a patch on the first part. 2.8.
Wow. That is a step down. I volunteer to go last.
Okay.
So in your faces, both of you.
Okay, so...
2.8.
Actually, I'm here to laud all of the positive things about this episode. Baines was still just as creepy, notched up the creepiness, as with Jenny. The family of Bloods, you know, the motive stayed relatively true. You know, aside from the actual minutiae of how they die, they were still, you know, they still had the great aim. Martha and Matron Daisy were fully amazing. How they were trying to marry their two worlds, how they were trying to marry their two wants for the same man with the same, you know, with slightly conflicting aims was just this delicious tete-a-tete every time they talked. Tennant had his moments, and then came back to facilitate the great moment, the Jessica Hines and a Ross Gwynning speech. Little Bojo was good up until the actual point where he was trudging through, you know, the trenches. He was this sort of skirting, shinning kid. There's loads of holes. The straw men were weird, but like I said, I think that's facilitating the shooting through tears motif. The headmaster was all headmasters, from what I can gather, in 1913, marching the boys off to war in glorious fashion. It was one of the best historicals as a corpus, both last episode and this. And actually, it didn't let me down as a resolution. It's still, you know, in the same way that Daleks and Manhattan and what was the first one called?
Well, that wasn't.
That was the first
one. What's the second one? Evolution of Daleks.
Oh, there you go.
Where I said that the first portion had this great New York bit to it, and we lost that, I think, in the second part.
Yeah.
I didn't lose pre-war or pre-First World War Britain and First World War Britain in this. That was a strong theme. You know, all of that, that Prussian stuff about the war, regents or the shores of England and the brutality of it all. People really died. It was so emotional for me watching this one. It still does. It's still there. It's 10 years later. There's so many fucking weird things about this episode, but I can't help but that this is actual fucking drama in Doctor Who. Real, earnest, well thought through emotional rawness. So I'm going to give it less than the first, but a 4.0.
Wow. Okay.
I don't have a problem with that.
Nor should you.
Well, no, I just mean, this episode has a ton of great scenes, but for me, it was just less than the sum of its parts.
Well, I could echo most of the things that you've said here. I'll add to what you said about the emotional aspect of this. Yeah, I agree. I was incredibly touched, is the wrong word, but I got very emotional seeing these children. So just, oh, the tension of that scene was heartbreaking, but almost more so, I thought, heartbreaking, the tension of that inner conflict of Mr. Smith's, the self-negating conflict of, am I just a story? Am I just made up? But I want to have a life. I don't remember this doctor. I don't want to kill myself to become someone else, and so on and so forth. I will disagree with you, Drood. Well, I will agree with you, but add something more to it.
What a roller coaster.
Yes, Martha and Daisy were spectacular. Agree with you on that.
Oh, yeah.
And that they reaffirmed. Were one of the few things that sort of carried over from part one.
Drop that.
That's right. Keep on agreeing with
me. Drop that.
But
yeah,
I'm going to disagree with you about the family of blood. I don't think they were all about having a tilted head and no message. I thought, if anything, Baines once again proved that he was an incredibly capable actor. There's that one scene where he's talking about, like, we're going on a hunt. I can't do the voice at all, but like when he talks about them going hunting finally because they've been sort of almost dormant and for such a long time. Incredibly well done. That weird grin of his. I've got an inward boner just thinking about it now. I think he's a fantastic actor. There are so many plot holes in this that normally you can sit down, or if it's a good episode, you can sit down, you can discuss it for 90 minutes, you can discuss it for 90 days, for goodness sake, and just find more and more good bits about an episode. But in this one, I feel like we really did focus on the bad things, and maybe we didn't get Martha and Daisy the you know, attention that they deserved in this episode or in this double feature. But that's because the bad things are so incredibly bad that they really outweigh all that. And for that reason, I am deducting from my final score. I'm giving this a 3.5, which is still a respectable score. It's just nowhere near what I gave the first one.
Well, 2.8 is above halfway. You know, it's not a bad episode.
Yeah. We have once again not received any mini reviews for this one, ladies and gentlemen of Podcast Land.
Hot Podcast Land.
Yeah. Shame on you.
I think we need to parlay some of our classic Who reviews into the new Who.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we probably have some people who only listen to the new and not to the old, or vice versa.
Put this episode out as C044. See how long it takes people to figure it out.
But we do get a lot of minis for the classics. You know what? Next time, we're going to be discussing Blink, and I bet you a lot of people in Podcast Land have a thing or two to say about Blink. So if you do, please do send us some minis for that one.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to be brilliant. Just tell us what you think.
Heard that before.
Actually, please don't make it long.
Yeah, please don't.
250
words.
Yeah.
That is the limit. Unless we receive like 6 or 7 of them, in which case we might truncate all the same. Okie dokie. Is it time for goodbyes?
Oh, yeah. I think my house has to be cooler than this. Or I'll just go and sit in your fridge. I really don't care which.
Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Next time on New Who, we've already said it, we've got Blink. In Classic Who, we have
The Dominator. The Dominators.
Yeah, there's more than one.
Yeah.
You'd have to pay double.
Yeah, it's a fully intact episode, ladies and gentlemen, so just heads up, you can still send in some minis for that one.
Yeah, which you will, because it's a classic. Not bitter or anything, but whatever.
And the next audio Who that we'll be reviewing is
The Escape Goat.
Yes.
In the meantime, why don't you find Ladies and Gentlemen of Podcast Land, follow us on Twitter. On my left, we have Nicolelli. Are you on Twitter, Nick?
I am. And here is a soundbite of Drew singing. That?
Yes. N-I-K-U-L-E-L-E. That spells Nick. Ulele. Bit like ukulele. Not quite ukulele. Now that's done. Let's move on.
Well done, Drew.
Thanks, Drew.
To my right, we have Drew. Can people follow you on Twitter?
You can. I am both Radtastic and Bodacious on Twitter. At Drew Back When.
I'm Drew Back When. You'll like me.
And I am Ponkin. High five me on Twitter. I'll high five you right back. Here's a soundbite of JD singing How You Spell That.
P-O-N-K-E-N. Ponkin.
Thanks, JD. Again, thanks again for listening. Rock on, be rad next to each other. Ciao.
Bye.
You really harmonized on that one.
Oh, we've been doing that for a while.
Yeah. Kablamo. Did you enjoy the show? Then please do what the cosmos compels you to and spread the gospel of Who Back When. Tell your friends. Don't have any friends? No problemo. Tell some strangers. Like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/whobackwhen. All in one word. Are you on Google Plus? Then find us on Google Plus. That's plus Who Back When. And when you do, tell us why you're on Google Plus. Who Back When just got its very own Twitter account, no lie, so give us a follow. You guessed it, that's at Who Back When, all in one word. Check us out on SoundCloud, vote us up on Reddit, listen to us on Stitcher, and head on over to our website, whobackwhen.com, where you can leave a comment, submit a review of your own, and peruse our visual index of aliens, monsters, and more, which increases in kablamos with every episode. And lastly, give us a rating and review on iTunes. Not only would it make us super chuffed, and it really, really would, but as thanks, we will transmigrate your iTunes nom de plume into the credit list of trailers for fake Doctor Who audiobooks produced by Who Back When. Have a poke around our bonus episodes to make more sense of that. That's it. Rock on and be rad and excellent to each other. Catch your ear balls in our next Classic Who Review, New Who Review, or, still funny, Audio Who Review. Ciao.
Who Back When.